Hi, I'm Mary Wilson, and I'm interviewing Renee. Renee, how do you pronounce your last name, by the way?
Slatiper.
Slatiper. I was afraid I was going to say it incorrectly, and I realized as I was about to say it that I've never actually heard it said. So thank you. This is October 16th, 2020, and Renee and I are going to be talking about his story and the ministry that he is a part of and leading during the pandemic. So, first of all, Renee, would you share with those who are listening some of your background and formative experiences that have helped shaped you to be the minister you are today?
Well, how long do we have?
As long as we need. I know it's a big question.
So my name is Renee. My pronouns are he, him, his. I grew up in San Antonio, not really going to church at all. I moved to Austin very quickly, right after college. I went to school in San Marcos, and I've been here for about 20 years. And I got into ministry through a Pride service that I had gone to. Was going to a UMC church for quite a while, and really felt called to ministry. And when I changed and ended up going the route of the UCC, and so I'm a member in discernment right now. I'm seeking a ministry license and seeking ordination as well in the UCC. And I am at Chicago Theological Seminary going to school. I am a minister right now in a college ministry called Labyrinth Progressive Student Ministry. And it's on the beautiful University of Texas campus. And it's a wonderful place to be. It's actually a wonderful place to be during the pandemic as well.
Yeah.
I really like being with the students. They teach me a lot every day as well about how to connect and how to use the technology that we have. So it's a wonderful place to be. I really enjoy it.
That's great. Well, now I have a ton of questions.
Yeah, of
Okay, so
course.
first of all, when was the Pride service that you went to? Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, that would have been, and I'm not entirely sure, it was probably 2011, 2012, maybe. And that was at University United Methodist Church. And it
Okay.
was a beautiful service. And they had the pride stoles there, I remember.
What was it about the service that felt so compelling?
It was just lovely to be in community, in a spiritual space with other queer people. They may not have the exact same story as me. I always say we may not be singing the same lyrics, but we can hum the same tune. That kind of thing. And so it that to me was it was that was my first experience in having that, and it was just beautiful. And I believe I met the pastor of that church that evening. And had a great conversation with him and ended up just checking it out. And man, I dipped my toe in slowly for sure.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I was there.
Oh, really? That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I was baptized at UUMC in 2013.
Okay,
Yeah.
nice. And had you been attending that particular Methodist church prior to the service? Is that the one you've been going to? Okay.
Yeah. So I had been going there for a while. Yeah. But
Okay.
dipping my toe in. Yeah.
So popping in and out a little bit. Sort of on the sly, if you will. Not ready to, So what drew you to start attending, just in checking it out to begin with?
Just knowing it was a safe space for me.
Safe space. Okay.
Yeah. I was already incredibly spiritual and seeking that experience. I just needed to know I was safe there.
Right. And that raises a question for me. What does safety look like to you?
Safe to be myself, to question myself and have that be okay. And safe to question about God I think was also really important to me. It's a Methodist church, so you know, there's a lot of that going on, and to me that felt safe to have that framework as well at the time, and to really question those things.
Well, had you had experiences where you had felt unsafe
in churches?
Yes.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, certainly. Okay. I had worked for a nonprofit for a few years, and that had me in a lot of faith spaces. We were doing, I worked for the Marrow Donor Program.
Okay.
And so we were asking for marrow donations, but we did it in a lot of places of faith. And there were a lot of places I did not feel safe. Mm. You get to hear the message sitting in the back waiting. Right. To give, you know, your testimony and talking about what you do. And yeah, it was, that could be a little jarring in some places.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. You may have said already, and it went right by me, but where did you grow up?
I grew up in San Antonio.
San Antonio. Okay. That's what I thought you had just said. And, you know, San Antonio is a big place. What part and what environment was your life like in San Antonio?
Oh, I grew up in the northeast side of San Antonio.
Okay.
It's predominantly middle class. I would say it's a good mixture of races. You know, the school that I went to, I would say was predominantly white, and then very close Hispanic, and then, you know, we had a few Black people at our school, but not very many.
Mm-hmm.
But we are military, it's a military town, and so because of that, I feel like it allowed for more diversity in races. Mm. which was always really nice to go to school and just have everyone was very different, and it was nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you ever get drawn to the military being in San Antonio? And it's
sure, of course,
great military city, USA. Yeah,
of course. But you know, I grew up through Don't Ask, Don't Tell. You know.
Yeah. Okay.
And I came out at 14. It was I came out at a very young age as a lesbian, and I didn't actually come out. It was actually just, you look like this, you talk like this, this is what you are.
Ah.
And so I questioned that. I was like, oh, does that mean I get to still dress the same? Like, are you just labeling me this? This isn't like a bad thing. And it wasn't a bad thing to a lot of my peers. It was just, this is what you are. Mm-hmm. And so I accepted it.
Mm-hmm. When were you able to find your own way as opposed to one that was
like prescribed for me?
Prescribed for you. Yes. That's a good way to say it. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I don't think that happened until I was really allowed to question myself and question my body. Mm-hmm. And feel like I had autonomy really over myself. And that did not happen. You know, it doesn't happen when you turn 18.
No.
And it didn't happen really until my late 20s when I just started to, things started to make more sense to me. I also didn't have the language for it.
Sure.
You know, we didn't have that word growing up. Yeah. And if we did, it was not a good word.
Right.
And so, yeah. For me, I think that was, that was about the time when I started to question. Now, I had always, you know, in my mind known something, but I didn't know what that was. And then when I learned the word, for me, it was like, that's it. Okay. That's the word. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That must have felt good to have something that felt right.
Sure, it felt good and terrifying all at the same time.
Fair enough. Yes.
Right? You know, coming to terms with something about yourself that the world does not view well is never easy.
No.
No matter what it is. And for me, it was, oh crap, here we go again. There was a lot of that. There's a lot, and it's a lot of the same things all over again, and it gets easier. I will say that.
Good. Well, I'm glad for that, for you.
Yeah.
Well, it strikes me that as a minister for a progressive student ministry, that you have a lot to offer in terms of helping students just come into their own, identify with their own identities and so forth. Could you talk a little bit more about what you feel you bring to the ministry at UT?
I don't know that I bring any like special brand of spirituality that's going to be unique that anybody else would not bring. But what I think I do bring is the ability for students to recognize themselves in someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that in a lot of different ways. For some, it might be, I want to be in seminary. Like that's my next step. Uh-huh. Tell me about that process. For some, it might be, I was in the UMC and it didn't feel affirming, and you're in the UCC. Tell me what that's like.
Yeah.
There's some of that. There's a lot of things that students might identify with, but what I think they do, and I think what we're kind of talking about, is the identity of queer and Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And how do I be both? What does that look like? Mm-hmm. Because we can talk about saying that is accepted, sure, that is welcomed, sure, that is affirmed. But what does that look like to go through an entire process being affirmed? And I think we're learning that. Mm-hmm. And what do those students need? I'm learning that now. I have students that have, from the moment they came out, been loved, affirmed, encouraged, you know, loved into, you know, ministry, and they're in student ministry.
Mm-hmm.
And they're right next to another student who has an evangelical background.
Right.
And they're right next to a student who is an atheist. And
sounds
this
like
is not
very fascinating mix of students.
Exactly. And so it's and it's not like the start of a joke, you know, like this is what happens, you know, all the time. And so their eyes are being opened to these different ideas of what life could have been like. What could have been my lived experience. And so what I do is I talk with them about that lived experience. And how it's helped them think about God,
mm-hmm.
and help them think about their own theology and their own story in that theology, because we want to see ourselves represented in Scripture. We want to be validated too. So, you know, I help them find those things. And I help them find those questions. I don't really know that I give them a whole lot of answers. But I help them find some questions that I think help them understand themselves and understand how to be both things, how to be both queer and Christian.
Yeah. I think it's, you can correct me, I think it's true that Labyrinth is not necessarily a queer student ministry. It is for all students.
It is for all students.
And yet it attracts a number of queer folks in order to have, as you talked about earlier, a safe space.
Mm-hmm.
And
what's fascinating, Mary, what's fascinating is we've been working with other student ministries.
Mm-hmm.
that are also mainline. These are mainline. These aren't ecumenical. These are like, this is like the Protestant student ministries, you know, this is the Lutheran yeah. student ministries. Those are also predominantly queer kids.
Interesting. Interesting. Why do you think that is?
Because they're in a place in college where they can question themselves, and they question the narrative that they've, a lot of them have been given.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so they look at the neighboring churches and they say, wait, that's not their story. Mm-hmm. This is the tradition I grew up in. And the tradition I grew up in might say one thing, or my parents might say one thing, but the tradition is being loving and accepting. And like, these people are cool and they're just like me. I want to hang out with them.
Yeah. So what is life like on the UT campus these days?
During the pandemic, it's bizarre. It is weird. It does not feel like it is, like right now it's almost midterms, and the university would be just packed full of students, and it's not. It feels like summertime when you're just walking through the campus, and you may see a couple people here and there, but it's just, there's no one around.
Yeah. So how does that impact your ability to do ministry on the campus?
We aren't really doing anything on campus. I say that's not true. I would say we do about 25% on campus. And what that looks like is we meet with masks on outside, socially distant, 6 feet apart, and we do meditation.
Mm.
Or we may, and we've had services outside. We're a small group. We can do that.
Yeah.
We can have the space, and we've recorded. We've done both. So we're recording, but we're also outside. It changes the way that we do some rituals, right? So communion, we've had to change how we do that. Communion can only be done virtually.
Mm-hmm.
We're okay with that. We do a lot of, when we do meet in person, we limit who can speak. We don't sing. We do have music that is played. We have someone that plays but no one sings. And yeah, the only people who are allowed to speak are me and Anna while we're preaching or speaking. Uh-huh. But we do prayers. And so what we do is we give each person like some marbles, or we've used blocks of wood, and we light a candle, and everybody can place their prayer on the altar, you know, as they'd like to.
Yeah.
It's just changed how we do things.
Right.
But the sentiment is still the same.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And do you do some things online as well then?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have students who are not in Austin, for instance, right, and are joining online?
Yes. So anything that we do in person, we do online as well.
Oh,
that includes meditation, that includes worship, that all of those things.
Right. Okay.
We used to have a student lounge, and that used to be a great place for students to meet up, and it's not open, but it's not closed either. We use it as a food pantry space now.
Oh.
And so students are coming in and basically keep treating it like a grocery store. They'll come in, grab what they need. We even give them bags to take with them. And they'll use it as a space to study. We really only have one student that does that. And that's really because she doesn't have a space. She's in the dorms. Other than her room, there's no other place for her to go on campus. So
yeah.
That's pretty negligible. She's always wearing a mask. It's fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, we have something. Oh, go ahead.
I was wondering, I was going to shift a little bit, so I don't want to cut you off, but I was wondering how then the pandemic, how has the pandemic not only affected the ministry portion, but then your personal life too, in the midst of trying to be a minister? What is different for you?
Well, that's my dog. which leads me to talk about this. So my partner and I share a very small one-bedroom apartment. We have two cats and a dog. And he is a music director for the Paramount. Which is a theater company here in town. He does educational theater, so he works with kids and teaches them about music and about storytelling and story writing. He does this from our living room. I don't know if you can tell, in a closet in our bedroom. He basically has a little studio in the living room, and this is what we've done to get by. And you know, it'll be fine. We're moving hopefully soon. So it's been hard, right? So personally, and trying to do your work while your partner is also doing work, and it changes a lot, and I wouldn't say your personal life difficult. It makes it more challenging for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That little phrase, and it's fine. The tone is exactly the opposite of fine. When you say that, it's more of we're making it work, but it's really not fine.
We're faking it till we make it, Mary. We're just like, we're fine. This is fine. The kitchen's on fire around us. We're fine.
So what do you do for yourself to navigate this fine world you're living in?
What do I do for myself? That's a good question. I do a lot of meditation. So I facilitate meditation. I run a meditation group. But I also do my own as well. I have my own practice, which is helpful.
Do you have a particular style of meditation that you do?
I don't. I do lots of different types. And I always tell people, like, there's more than one flavor of ice cream. You know, like, learn them all. Go have fun. But I was trained to do centering prayer.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And how is that helpful to you?
I think it's helpful to have a spiritual practice, whatever that practice is. And I would say it's a habit, and forming a spiritual practice or forming compassion or forming whatever you want for yourself is a practice. And just like working out, you're just like a muscle, you know, you have to work out that muscle in order for it to actually work for you. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, for me, that's my spiritual practice, you know, of meditation is very similar to that. It's like a workout for me. Mm.
So do you do it every day, multiple times a day, or what is your routine?
Every day, usually. I mean, there's times when I miss, for sure. I don't make it a thing that, like, this is punishable, because it's not good for anybody.
Right.
But in times of stress, I intentionally set twice a day.
Oh, okay.
And during the pandemic, that has certainly been a helpful practice for me, for sure.
Good. What has been the hardest part of the pandemic for you?
Not going anywhere.
Yeah.
Right. Like we don't go anywhere. And for the longest time, like I wasn't the one going to the grocery store. So I really didn't go anywhere. And that's a weird, we aren't meant to, like, as people, we're not meant to live alone. A side note, I did a camping trip, a 40-day camping trip alone. Been like 40 days in the wilderness. And I'm so glad I did, because I think I would have had a lot more anxiety during this time.
Oh yeah.
But I was able to kind of like recognize and see like, oh, this is part of that process when people are alone too long of what happens.
Oh, okay.
And just
can
like,
you give some examples about that? What happens when people are alone for a long time?
Oh, so like, you know, more talking to yourself, you know, those kinds of things, more rapid thoughts, and just you have the time.
I'm thinking of the picture of my mind is Tom Hanks and Castaway talking to the volleyball.
That is a very real thing that does happen, and we will do anything to keep our sanity, and our sanity is really based on a reality that we need people.
Yeah.
And when we don't have people around us, the effects of that are really powerful.
Yeah.
And some of the things that they really do lead you to believe, like, oh, we really do need each other. You know, even though people, we know, like, people are ugly and we can be we're our own worst enemies, but we need each other.
Yeah.
And so you really start to recognize that. And then, you know, towards the end of it, you also just, things start to quiet down inside your mind. Things become very different. And when you are coming back into the world again, everything is brighter and louder, and it's hard. It's a bit much. It's a hard adjustment.
The senses are heightened because they've been in some ways suppressed. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, yeah, exactly. And so everything, you start to realize, like, man, NPR is really loud, you know, and a lot, and you're bombarded by news all day long.
Yeah.
So
this need to be together, I'm very sympathetic to the desire that we all have to spend time with one another. How does that seem to be playing out with the students in the ones you see on campus? Or
I'm glad you asked that, because I'm a very optimistic person, and I want to like see the good in things. Mm-hmm. And I've been able to see a lot of really good come out of this. And one of the really good that came out of this is the co-minister of Labyrinth and I, we early in the year rethought how we were communicating and what we were communicating. Mm-hmm. And started switching more towards social media. Mm-hmm. To communicate, and that became very successful. And then what we realized is, you know, emailing or texting is not the way to do things anymore. We have a Discord server, which is similar to like a Slack or, you know, a communication channel.
Right.
And what we found is students preferred to interact that way. And it was really helpful for us. So we started setting those up really early in the pandemic, and the students ran with it, and it was great.
They can all be on there at once, and it's a little more organized, if you will, than just a group text message. And
right,
you can manage it individually a little bit differently than something like
that. It's also something that is passive communication. So it is not a text message, which for some folks is impulsive to look at and
right.
to respond to.
Right, right.
When it's a Discord chat, you can easily just be like, I can get to that later. It's mm-hmm. really not that important.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is it's probably not. It's probably a picture of someone's cat.
Yeah.
But we wanted to give students a place to put those things.
Right.
You know, to have a place to put the picture of their cat that they were really excited about, and to share that with others. And it worked. And they're really happy with it. And they've gotten to know each other and make friends without ever actually meeting each other.
Yeah. Do you think they're looking forward to actually seeing each other in person?
I do. I do. And I think there is some anxiety with that. We have some kids that have a lot of social anxiety, I think, and to be fair, some of that has also to do with, I feel, not knowing if they can trust these people that are a part of the church. Does that?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Am I safe here?
Yes.
And so they get to decide for themselves what safety looks like. Mm-hmm. And so for them being out and being part of this community might look like I'm safe online.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. And that feels okay for me right now.
Right. Right. But
Exactly. And so it's for some of them online is great. And then for some of them, meeting in person is just imperative.
Sure.
And so we have those in-person meditations and, you know, there's, I can be with you and see you and you can be a part of this. And for them, that's very meaningful.
Right. Right. I'm going to change topics completely here because you mentioned earlier that you're Chicago Theological Seminary, and I know that it is predominantly an online school and has been prior to the pandemic, or at least has opportunities there. How is school going for you during this? And has it really changed any than what it was before?
Not for me. Yes and no. So I'm at Chicago, but prior to that, I was at Lexington, which was also online. So for me, it's getting used to a different style of online.
Oh, okay.
So at Lexington, my classes were shorter and mm-hmm. everything was like this. Whereas at Chicago, I have one thing to do a week. And I'm used to a much faster pace.
Yeah.
But that's good to know. Maybe that means I can take more classes than I thought I could. Mm-hmm. Which would be great. I could finish faster.
Right.
It's a little different. I will say that there are students that I'm in class with that were supposed to be in person that are online that are struggling.
Mm.
And mm-hmm. I feel for them so, so much.
Yeah.
I also feel as if there are I feel like there was at the very beginning of the year, an expectation for some of the classes that I'm in for them to be really rigorous and then they realized, oh, this is too much work. Students are starting to complain about too much work.
Mm.
And so I feel like that, and then a lot of things became optional.
So what I'm hearing and what I have heard in other venues and seen is that professors are also trying to adapt to, one, not just being online and being appropriately rigorous, but the reality that people are home with their jobs, at home with their families, at home, and they're not just working, you know, one part of the day and taking a class one part of the day and caring for their families, children, potentially another part of the day. It's all happening at once, which makes it much more difficult to figure out what's an appropriate assignment. And so it's not even just that it's online, it's the fact that it's happening in the pandemic and trying to figure out how to manage lives.
It's hard. I don't I don't envy them at all. And I had that conversation, you know, with another student, which is, you know, it's hard. So the last seminary I was at, they were doing for quite a few months, a lot of pass fail. Mm-hmm. And that is really because of this situation.
Right.
And they were doing some very interesting grading things of, if you put in enough effort, or everyone gets a B, but if you put in the extra effort, you know, you'll get the A. If you put in zero effort, you're going to fail, but mm-hmm. you put in some effort, you'll get the B.
Yeah.
Which is weird, but okay.
Well, I've talked to someone in our local school district, you know, talking about, we're not going to fail an 11-year-old in the middle of a pandemic. We're not. We're going to figure out other options to get the information, to get the education delivered in ways that are beneficial, but we're not going to fail an 11-year-old in a pandemic when life is crazy. So it sounds like that extends in some ways, not just to 11-year-olds, but maybe 41-year-olds or whatever age it is in between. So, wow. How are your students at UT feeling that? Are they having similar experiences as well? Or
For some of their classes, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for some of their classes, yeah. But for some of them, the only thing that changed was lecturing. That's done online now. The work, the reading, the workload, most of that stayed the same. They were already doing discussions, I believe, online anyway, as part of their participation or what have you.
Right.
Class discussions. So none of that was new for them. For a lot of them, they've had some issues with professors not having lectures done or mm-hmm. recorded, but like sounded weird or, you know, all of those things.
So I don't want to put words in your mouth, but maybe the summation here is, people are working very hard and it's not always going smoothly.
No. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, you're doing your best, but like that's, you know, it's not always going to cut it. And the thing is that needs to be okay right now.
Yes. Yes. Well, I want to be aware of the time and your time in particular. Want to take too much more time, but I do want to ask if there's anything that we have maybe glossed over that you wanted to come back to or that I just didn't touch that you think is important to share, either about your personal story or about your ministry right now.
No, just that I think in the midst of the pandemic, in the midst of, you know, doing ministry in the pandemic, we need to revision how, not just, you know, revision church, yeah, everyone knows that, but I think it's revisioning also, like, how do we communicate, what are we saying about ourselves, mm-hmm. are the things that we're doing, are those on brand for mission, and starting to talk about those things and making everything really clear, mm-hmm. and understanding those pathways and understanding like your direction of where you're going. Because gosh, it made a big difference, and keeping our community together and growing our community, was really knowing how to communicate.
Yeah. And I would expect that growing your community in a college environment has some unique challenges because it's already transitory, just given the fact that students aren't there forever to begin with. So you have unique challenges compared to, say, a church that's brick and mortar, has, here's our place and here's where we've been for, you know, 30, 50, 100 years. Student ministries are entirely different in that regard, which is one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you, because I thought you would have a different kind of take on ministry than some of the other pastors that I've been able to talk to. And that's certainly true. But what do you think is the most unique piece about being a student minister in this time in particular?
I don't know that it's necessarily unique. I think a lot of folks, if you're not worried about money, then you're doing your pastoral care calls, and it's both things at the same time, and it's holding both of those. And I don't think student ministry is any different. It's the same. We're out, you know, looking for the money, and we're also, you know, trying to figure out how we're going to keep our doors open once this is open or over, and then how are we going to see all the students that need to be seen and need some time also. So it's a juggle, and I don't think it's any different than anyone else's. Maybe the approach is different.
That's fair. Well, Renee, I want to thank you for joining me today and for sharing your story, sharing your ministry, and I appreciate all that you've added to the conversation. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks.